Hello and welcome to yet another episode of The Ecocentrics. I'm Tom.
And I'm PK. This week we're going to discuss climate tipping points.
And just how close we might be to the edge.
And can we tip the scales in the opposite direction?
Let's see. So.
It just got that.
Oh dear.
All right. We're going to discuss the tipping points. There are 9 tipping points.
Oh, hot topic.
Are there more? Are there 17,000?
It's disputed how many tipping points there are. So some of the earlier papers around this identify 9 tipping points within the Earth system. But some of the more recent work, so some 2022 work, starts to show that there's actually about 16 or potentially 16 tipping points in the climate systems. So there's debate around how many exactly there are, but somewhere between 9 and 16 is a good number to go with.
Somewhere in between 9 and 16. Well, I'm going to work on 9, but I'm happy to hear anything about a potential other 7 coming into the fold, sadly. But I imagine there would be tipping points. And with each of them, there'd be sub-tipping points, I imagine, as well. It could be infinite. But what we know is they're all critical. So these are basically places where the changing climate could push parts of the Earth's ecosystem into abrupt or irreversible change.
And I think it's important to say that the idea of tipping points comes from systems mechanics and looking at how systems work. And really critically, they are building on the idea of feedback loops, where one thing interacts with another thing, interacts with another thing. And to give you a perfect example of this in our climate system, if you go to the poles, obviously right now, relatively white places, and white is a reflective surface, which means radiation from the sun reflects back into space. However, as ice starts to melt, this changes the color of the surface to a darker color because it becomes ocean. And this absorbs more heat, which therefore melts more ice, which therefore allows more heat to be absorbed in the future. This is the sort of tipping point mechanic we're talking about here. It's these feedback loops within our systems, which go to an exponential growth curve. So rather than things happening in a linear fashion, so 1, 2, 3, 4, things are happening in a doubling fashion because things are exacerbating over time.
It's like compound interest, but not as rewarding. So what are these tipping points? We have 2 distinct large ice sheets. One is the Greenland ice sheet. The tipping point is called the Greenland ice sheet disintegration. And in the southern hemisphere, we also have the West Antarctic ice sheet disintegration. Now, irreversible retreat of these ice sheets is caused by rising temperatures and also some of these feedback loops that Tom's just mentioned. And in the Greenland ice sheet, the potential sea rise is up to 7 meters, might be more now. And then in the West Antarctic ice sheet, the sea rise could be up to 3 meters. So altogether, that's quite a lot.
And I think what's really important in terms of how we think about this is the change isn't going to happen like that. All of a sudden, over the next 5 years, all the ice is going to disappear from the West Antarctic or disappear from Greenland. It will take centuries, if not millennia, for this ice sheet disintegration. However, with what we're doing today, we're putting the energy within the system, with the burning of fossil fuels, to set the system mechanics in motion, and then moving towards this irreversible state, or positive tipping point, or tipping point, where change will continue to happen no matter what we do. And I think that's what's really important within this, is that it's not going to happen immediately. We're not going to see 10 meters of sea level rise in my or PK's lifetime. But from an intergenerational justice perspective, actually, we are setting in motion what's going to be happening in the future. With the West Antarctic ice sheet, we are expecting to see us crossing that tipping point at around about 2 degrees. 2 degrees on our current trajectory is something that we'll definitely see in my lifetime. And it shows us how close we are to actually changing the whole landscape of society.
Yeah, so even before we get to that, every tenth of a degree matters significantly. So even with a moderate emission scenario of reaching 1.7 degrees, the Arctic could be ice-free in the summer for the first time in the 21st century. And that's kind of ridiculous. And as Tom mentioned, if it's one of those lovely, large, white, frozen areas. It's great for reflecting heat back out from the earth. If it's gone, we absorb more heat and we lose that reflective surface. And in terms of the ice sheets, between 1970 and the mid-2000s, the decline of ice area has declined by 10% per about a decade. This is according to satellite imagery. But in the last few decades, that's accelerated. And we continue to see there's every indication that the model will continue to be that way, where the ice sheets will continue to lose more and more ice every year. So, what are some other of the tipping points? Well, we have the permafrost loss. And the permafrost loss, that's a large expanse of area. So, mostly you're thinking of northern Canada and northern Russia, but permafrost can exist on mountaintops. It can exist in other areas in the United States, just anywhere where frozen land, like ice, acting as a glue, holding land, soil, rock together, and it has to be at least 2 years straight for it to be considered permafrost.
Permafrost is one of these tipping points for several reasons, but most importantly, as permafrost thaws, it releases methane. And we've spoken about this already. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas. And you might have seen videos before of people going with a lighter, they're going to stab a piece of ice, and they put a lighter over the top of it, and they go, poof! And that is the methane escaping and lighting on fire. And with this permafrost thawing, we release more and more of these methane emissions. And there was an interesting paper released, well, it was a couple of years ago now, just towards the end of the pandemic, which looked at global methane levels. And actually, we would expect global methane levels to go down during the pandemic, obviously, alongside all the other emissions that we saw a decrease in that time. But the scientific data is showing that methane levels were still rising. And that is starting to show us that maybe we're starting to get near a tipping point. We're starting to see more methane, even though human activity isn't necessarily driving that. And there's debate about where that's come from within the scientific community. However, it's not a good sign.
It's not. The other implications of that as well, and the impact on humans, not to mention on animals, is it destabilizes buildings and transport systems. It also can release viruses, fungi, bacteria that have been frozen and inactive. And that sounds like science fiction. However, in 2016, a Russian anthrax-carrying reindeer was unfrozen in permafrost after 75 years, and that's only an animal that's been frozen for 75 years. So there are definitely areas where some of this stuff has been frozen for hundreds to thousands of years. Now, the anthrax got into the water supply system. It sickened dozens of people, and sadly, a young boy died as well. And also, thousands of reindeer perished. And we will be sure to link that scientific paper in the show notes. But that's just one anthrax-carrying deer that was unfrozen in the permafrost. And that's just one small thing that it can impact, as well as you can also impact indigenous communities are at peril as well.
So I went to an amazing lecture a few years ago, which was delivered by some Sami people who are indigenous folk who span across Norway, Sweden, and Finland. It talked about how the changes in permafrost and the thawing of permafrost changed the direction of their travel because they're a roaming community which take their reindeer across vast swathes of land. And actually, all of this permafrost thaw was changing what they could do because it was destabilizing certain ground patterns.
Yeah. And recently, another permafrost-related issue that just happened a few days before we're about to release this, it happened on June 11th, is in Austria on the Flugthorn Mountain. The partial summit collapsed, releasing 100,000 cubic meters of rock. And the scientists there say it was because of the rising temperatures and climate change and permafrost melting, which is happening across many mountainous regions, impacting villages below. But what are some other of the tipping points?
The AMOC.
Which is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation Breakdown, or AMOC, AMOC. Now, the shutdown of the AMOC is caused by an increased influx of fresh water into the North Atlantic. So if you get your map out, and it's a gigantic expanse of water, basically the Atlantic Ocean. So all up and down, you know, Greenland, eastern coast of the United States, on into the Caribbean islands, northwest of Africa, as well as all along the eastern part of Europe and the islands of the UK and Iceland as well. And what happens in this circulation system is that the water flows northward. As it flows northward, it cools, some of it evaporates, which then increases the salinity and therefore the water density. And when you have low temperature, high salt density, that water sinks down to the bottom. And then it slowly starts to migrate south, kilometers and kilometers under the surface of the water. Eventually, as it migrates south, it starts to get pulled back up. And I remember this from my elementary school courses where they talk about upwelling and all the nutrients that can bring up with it for the sea animals. But the upwelling process happens and then it all starts over again. And thereby, this is an important circulation system because it makes sure that the waters are being circulated and the nutrients are being circulated, but it critically impacts the heat and dispersion of heat and cool. And it also directly contributes to our seasons.
I find it really cool just thinking about it because basically it's just like a massive waterfall in the ocean, an absolutely enormous, deep, high volume waterfall just always falling off the side of the ocean. But obviously, as PK has already outlined, there is a tipping point in the AMOC system, which could cause a shutdown. And you may be familiar with the wonderful Ellie Noughties film, The Day After Tomorrow, which was the dramatization of this. What might happen? Because if the AMOC were to shut down, there would be basically an ice age in the Northern Hemisphere because of the impact that goes on with it. So there'll be really localized regional cooling as a result of this. So not all of these tipping points will create warming across the entire planet. Actually, this tipping point would cool down the Northern Hemisphere drastically. And there was some modeling done around about 4 years ago now, looking at the decline in the AMOC current, because it's already started to decline to a degree. There's only about a 20% chance it's actually going to shut down before 2100, even on a higher warming trajectory. So it's not one of the ones which is most pressing in terms of impact. However, obviously, still really important. But even with this slowing down of it, there were some models done of things like agricultural impact in the UK. And because of the role of the AMOC in bringing over rain into the UK and other parts of Europe, actually, its slowdown has the potential to massively decrease our arable output and our agricultural output because of the impact associated with reduced rain. Already, we need to be thinking about this and actually how we plan our future. And the fact that places like the UK actually might be a lot more arid than they maybe would have been before. The UK is wetter than it should be because of the way that the ocean currents work and because of what brings to the UK.
I didn't even make the connection from the film The Day After Tomorrow to the AMOC. I actually enjoyed that film.
Don't lie.
I did. It was really cool special effects at the time.
I only remember the wolf scene and being so young that I was quite scared.
Oh, it was a bit too much, yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit too much.
So another tipping point, which many people actually have probably heard of but didn't realize it was one of the tipping points, are the Great Coral Reef die-offs. And as we know, with rising temperatures, this causes stress to the corals and it causes ocean acidification as well. So it means these corals are unable to thrive. As that ecosystem changes, we will be losing tourism and fishery that are related to that.
Yeah, so 100% die-off effectively at 2 degrees, just catastrophic.
Human ingenuity would mean that we'd have coral reefs incubating in human laboratories and eventually get to a point where we could establish them somewhere. But at least in the wild, the vast amounts of coral we have now would be gone.
What's really interesting, kind of building on what you said there, PK, in terms of actually supporting corals to grow again, is some of the ingenious methods people are starting to use, where basically there are mini coral farms. And one of my friends used to work on one of these coral farms and go and plant the corals out in different parts of the ocean. And basically, it was a big research experiment to work out, okay, where does this stuff work that's planted? How effective does it work? And what's been really interesting to see recently as well is the role of fish ecosystems actually supporting that coral growth. And there's a symbiotic relationship between the species that live within that area and the coral too. So it was kind of just assumed that they were living their own lives independently. But actually, especially through looking at things through the noise of a coral environment, these sorts of things have started to make us realize that things like fish are really important in helping develop those environments. And actually, maybe they'll be more useful in helping the regrowth of corals.
Yeah, and something that you mentioned there, Tom, when you lose something like a coral reef system, you are losing all the other animals that depend on that system. You know, humans are ingenious and we will come up with ways, but until that time, potentially we are losing hundreds of thousands of different species that will never recover, that will go extinct. And some of them we don't even know about. And yet another major tipping point that, again, people have probably heard about but didn't know it was one of the tipping points is the Amazon rainforest dieback. And as many of you know, it's deforestation for a variety of reasons, whether it's growing soybeans to feed animal agriculture or if it's for cattle. As we deforest, it makes things hotter, it makes conditions drier, and that is causing a shift towards a more savanna-like ecosystem. So the impacts of that are increased biodiversity loss and also decreased rainfall because that forest generates its sort of own humidity and its own drip. That's why it's called a rainforest. There's different areas where it virtually feels like it's raining while you're walking through it.
I think what's so cool about the Amazon is it literally makes its own clouds. Like the rainforest, the trees, all of the water vapor they're creating literally make their own clouds in their own system. And it's just like mind blowing that that can happen. And like the ingenuity of the natural world. And this is why it's a tipping point. There's disagreement about the exact percentage of Amazon deforestation, which will lead to a tipping point. But broadly, if we destroy around about 20% of the Amazon, it's likely to start pushing it towards this tipping point where we have the savannification of the Amazon basin because it doesn't create the weather systems that we need anymore. And it's terrifying, but also really interesting the fact that actually these systems respond in such a dynamic way. It's absolutely fascinating and mind-blowing that our Earth has the capacity to react in such a way to various interactions and the impacts of what goes on as a result of it.
Yeah, when you were talking about how it creates its own clouds, I was thinking of the Amazon rainforest, like those terrariums where you have like a big glass case that fully encloses some vegetation, some insects, and some soil, and it just creates its own closed loop system, just keeps feeding itself. There are two other tipping points that we're not going to go into today. They are important, but it's the West African monsoon shift and the Indian monsoon shift. But we recognize that we've covered a lot of information in this particular podcast. So we may revisit those at some other point, but we will link in the show notes to the Carbon Brief that will show you all of these tipping points we're talking about today, plus the monsoon shifts, where you can dive in a bit deeper and get a little bit more knowledge about these.
One final thing here, just to finish on, which is not a positive note, and we are going to get some positives in a second because there are tipping points in our social systems too, is there's also a lot of evidence starting to emerge now that tipping points aren't individual issues. And that actually, we can have what we call tipping cascades, or basically a domino effect, whereby one tipping point forces another tipping point to occur. And these interconnected systems have the capacity, if we go past one tipping point, to push another one to change. And this is really concerning, obviously, because of all the impacts it'll have and some of the things that PK and I've already mentioned. But actually, this has the potential to push the Earth into what we call a hothouse Earth state. So, for the last 12,000 years, in a period called the Holocene in geological terms, we've had this period of dramatic stability. So, the emergence of agriculture, farming has all been within this stable period. And as we start to push beyond that, we're leaving this zone of safety that human society has always thrived in, and we've never been outside of it. And pushing one of these tipping points, as I say, has the chance to push this cascade where we go to a hothouse Earth state, which exacerbates the warming and continues this trend in a negative trajectory for our civilization.
That's a good way of looking at it, Tom. It's not just tipping points, it's the cascading reactions that could come from this.
Good news now, please.
So I think it's good that I'm an excellent swimmer and that I used to lifeguard. So I might be okay. And, you know, I could probably make a raft. I'm pretty self-sufficient.
Oh, dear. So, we've obviously done a lot of doom and gloom in this episode so far. But what's really, really exciting is that using this systems approach, we can also see tipping points within our social systems for transformative change. And If we look over the recent past, we can already see some of these things as various bits of technology, as an example, become the norm. So if we take the example of something like the transformation of the horse and cart to the car, basically there was a 10-year period when everything changed. At the beginning of the last century, we moved away from one particular mode of transport because of all the associated impacts of it, particularly things like all the horse shit, which is all over the roads. And the idea was to move away to a less polluting mode of transport. And with all of these drivers, we said, okay, we'll do the car, shall we? And obviously, we see the car now as a negative in terms of carbon emissions, but actually, it shows that these systems, these changes can happen really, really rapidly once we start to have the systems in place to see radical change going on. And we see this with all sorts of things. We see it with things like washing machines in people's houses, mobile phone uptake, tablets, laptops, all of these things, which have kind of just rocketed in growth. And they've gone from something which no one had to something which everyone has in a 5 to 10 year period. And this is done using the idea of tipping points, not necessarily by design, but this is the mechanics of the system. Things become cheaper over time. There's more use of technology. There's more ways to interact with different pieces of software, which can therefore drive these massive changes. And there was a paper that was released last year, which is one of the most hopeful papers I've read on this subject in a long time, because we see lots of bad things around this, but actually there's some really exciting stuff too. There's a paper done by an organization called Systemic in collaboration with the University of Exeter, which looked at our complex Earth system and all of the things that we have within it. And they have identified what they call super leverage points. And these are three super leverage points which have the capacity to drive carbon emissions down by up to 70% globally. And the reason they can do this is because the system mechanics means that once things start happening, they unlock more potential in the future, enabling these things to become mainstream. The first of which is something that PK and I have actually already talked about, and it's transport and particularly battery electric vehicles. So you may remember from our earlier episode, I talked about the fact that Norway implemented a few policies which started to tip the purchase of new vehicles away from internal combustion engine vehicles to battery electric vehicles due to a few policy mechanisms. But on a bigger scale, as we start to increase battery electric vehicles, we will unlock this massive storage potential and really excite the battery market and bring down costs at this exponential rate. And this is going to be really, really, really important for our electricity system in the future. Having low cost storage is going to be essential for us to be able to manage the demand of our electricity system. So when it is really sunny, like it is today, or when it's really windy, we can capture electricity in batteries or other storage mechanisms to then be used at another time. And battery electric vehicles are really key within this journey, not because those batteries are going to be used, but actually because they're going to be driving forward that technology and helping unlock some of the transformational change.
And along with that, with the car battery and the storage, we'll start to get better and better at recycling the whole thing, basically, which is an issue at the moment. I like that, Tom. Are there more of those?
There are two more. The second of the tipping points which they have identified is green ammonia. So at the moment, we create ammonia for fertilizer, but it's created through quite a carbon intensive, fossil fuel intensive process. But actually, mandates for green ammonia could be really critical in starting to drive change. And this isn't just because we're decarbonizing that one tiny process within agriculture, which is obviously great, and will reduce emissions generally. But what this is important for is kickstarting the hydrogen economy. So, in doing this shift over to green ammonia rather than our normal ammonia, there is the potential to massively bring down the cost of the creation of green hydrogen, which can then be used as a fuel within all sorts of hard to decarbonize areas. And at the moment, hydrogen costs around about £4 per kilogram of hydrogen. And the golden price that the industry is saying we need to get to is £1 per kilogram of hydrogen. Using green ammonia, there isn't as much of an economic issue with this. So actually, we can use technology we develop in creating green ammonia to therefore bring down the cost of creating hydrogen and help us access low-cost hydrogen in the future.
That actually is exciting.
The final tipping point I identify is the growth of alternative proteins. And as PK and I have spoken about already on this podcast, food is responsible for a really big proportion of our carbon emissions. And alternative proteins, particularly things like lab-grown proteins, have the potential, if done well, to cut our emissions quite substantially within these areas. And this paper suggests that there should be a change in public procurement around plant proteins to enable and facilitate the growth of alternative proteins, therefore starting to unlock this market for alternative proteins and actually massively reduce the amount of livestock that is required generally. Their estimates are that this would free up between 400 and 800 million hectares of land. And that could be used for all sorts of things, but critically, it could be used for things like rewilding, enabling us to sequester more carbon.
Wow, that actually is amazing. And just last week, this sort of ties into something that I was in Scotland at something called the AMP4 project, which is about mitigating pollution on agriculture land. And part of that was five or six different work packages from different schools, from the University of Edinburgh to London School of Tropical Medicine to some Berlin connections. But one packet was looking at this, Tom, the alternative protein. So our current agriculture system, we know that humans, or at least in the UK, people are eating less meat anyway. So if they did nothing, would that draw down emissions fast enough? It really wouldn't. So they had two other hypotheses. So they had one where they have a carbon tax on meat and dairy products that is not as popular, obviously, with the public. But then they had this other hypothesis where if they could encourage people to just eat more fruits and veg, which would naturally displace the meats that you would eat, how that would then be better anyway and actually make those more affordable, because we are sort of subsidizing, we're subsidizing food products that have a high carbon output, and we're not subsidizing the foods that drive positive human health. But the third element was getting people to do these alternative proteins. And that actually had the biggest drawdown in emissions from their scenarios. However, they're highly manufactured processed foods. They can be high salt, fat, and sugar, but they did draw down emissions. So that I think the blend would be having some of these alternative proteins and then also eating more fruits and veg as well. It was really interesting. And I got this great pack of cards that had that could tell me how much water, carbon, all kinds of things were emitted from each of these foods.
This is somewhere that me and you will never agree, PK, because I think fake burgers and fake meat are the best thing ever. And I think you're wrong when you try and make me just have vegetables instead.
Now, I never said they weren't delicious. And now we've come to the part of the podcast for la quiz. Actually, I don't remember the French word for quiz. Is it similar?
I've no idea. I'd probably just say something which is inappropriate.
Yes, well, we'll save that for our R-rated show. So, all right, Tom, how much of landscape ground must be frozen to be called a continuous permafrost? 25%, 50%, 75%, 90%.
I presume it's quite a lot. Otherwise, it's just bog. I'm going to say it is the final answer, please. The high percentage answer.
90% is correct. 90 to 100% to be called a continuous permafrost. And if you're wondering, to be called discontinuous permafrost, it's anywhere between 50 and 90%, where some of the soil layers slightly melt, but shaded areas might stay frozen.
One of the most scary experiences of my life was when I tried to stand on some frozen bog once, and it wasn't fully frozen. And I went about nipple deep into this really terrifying bog. I just thought that might be it. I thought I was going to have to swim through a bog and see if I could escape. Luckily, someone just pulled me out immediately and it was fine. And they were a lot more calm than me, apparently, because I was screaming, arms in the air. But yeah,
Did it feel like quicksand?
it wasn't a good experience.
All right. Which is not a type of permafrost? Alpine, subsea, lateral, fluratial.
Subsea.
Incorrect.
Oh, you're just putting really hard questions in now to try and get me out, aren't you?
I actually made up the word pluracial.
Oh,
It's alpine and subsea are two types of permafrost.
there's the idea of methane hydrates as well, isn't there, in the bottom of the ocean?
Methane hydrates. It sounds like an energy drink.
Oh,
Okay. At 1.5 degrees Celsius of heating, what percentage of mountain glaciers will be lost? 10%, 25%, 33%, 100%.
let's not go 100%. Let's be positive and say it's only 33%.
It's even better. It's 10%.
Woo! A good answer.
I know. Well, relatively so.
It's the fact that we frame this, yeah, that's the good answer. Oh, only 10% of this pristine environment is going to get lost.
So that ends our quiz on the tipping points. And if you want to learn more, you can go to carbonbrief.org and we'll link those in the show notes. And that way you can dive deeper on some of these tipping points for yourself.
I also just want to say that you can also be part of these tipping points in our social systems as well. Just because these seem like big system-wide changes, they have to be driven by individuals and people within certain spaces. And you can be part of that change by actually stepping outside of your comfort zone and telling people about how important this is, and starting to spread the message about climate action and the fact that we need to do something. You can be the start of that tipping point within your community, your neighborhood, your town, to actually begin pushing things forward. And you never know, you actually might find lots more people like you that can push the tipping point even quicker.
Thanks for listening to the Ecocentrics. If you listen on Apple and like what you've heard, then please give us a review and a good one.
And make sure you hit the little button to say follow so you never miss an episode.
And if you'd like to get in touch or send us a voice note, our email is hello@theecocentrics.com.
You can also find us on all of the social medias, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and apparently TikTok.
So until next week, ciao.
Bye.
The Ecocentrics is produced by Emma Newman.
Theme and quiz music produced by Morgan Bryan.